So you didn't come to hear me speak. So with that, thanks for being here, and Governor Chris Christie.
Good morning. All right, well, I'm happy to be back in Pella. See some folks here that I've met before. I thank you for coming back. Some new folks too. Thank you for coming to listen this morning. This is the first of four town halls that I'll do today. And so we're gonna be traveling all over the state between now and Monday and working hard because you're getting ready to decide. For those of you who haven't decided, tick tock. Right, you got till Monday night. So it's time for people to decide, and I wanna make our last pitch to you. You know, I hope most of you watched the debate last night. I felt good about how we did because we listened to the questions and we actually answered them. Yes. Right? I mean, that's like what you're supposed to do, I think. And that's what we did last night. And that's what I'll do as president. You know, fact is that the way politics has been working in Washington, D.C. was exemplified last night by that argument that was going on between Senator Cruz and Senator Rubio. They showed video of them saying something, right? I mean, not like they read a quote off of a, you know, piece of paper that maybe they took down right or wrong. They actually showed multiple clips of Senator Cruz and Senator Rubio saying something on immigration. Now, quite frankly, I don't care what their position is on immigration. Whatever it is, it is. And if you've changed your position on immigration, that's okay too, as far as I'm concerned, as long as you tell people the truth about what you feel now and why you changed your mind. You know, I had lots of ideas when I was in my 30s, but now that I'm in my 50s, my ideas are different. This happens to all of us. And I think so, for some reason, politicians get into this mindset, especially the Washington ones, of saying, I can't ever let people think I changed my mind. I have to convince them that what they're hearing is really the same thing. Well, man, we watched that last night, right? It wasn't the same thing, it was different. And that's why I finally just jumped in and said, okay, come on, stop. I feel like you need a Washington to English dictionary converter, right? I mean, you know, and that's the problem, and that's why I think we need to send a governor to Washington, D.C., who hasn't been part of that problem, to say that to them when they come to the White House to argue some ridiculous point. Look at them and just say, listen, I got sent here to do a job. And you can talk all you want. But now let's get down to getting things done for the people who sent us here. And we need a president who has that experience. I've done that with the Democratic legislature now for the last 6 years in New Jersey. And it's not easy. I'd give my right arm for 1 week with Craig Paulson as the speaker in New Jersey. Just a week, that's all. We never sleep. Paulson and I would not sleep for a week. We do so many great things for the people of New Jersey, and then I let him go to sleep for a week. But we need someone who knows how to do these things and get them done. Because here's why. The stakes are too high. I just want to say one more thing. I'll take your questions for the rest of the time. I watched the Democratic town hall here in New Hampshire, or here in Iowa, sorry. What day is it? Monday? Thursday? Which? And I watched that town hall meeting, and a great Iowan, direct, like you are, stood up and asked Hillary Clinton about this email situation. And she said that the reason she had a private server in her home and the reason that she had, you know, this unsecure device that she carried around was for her convenience. Convenience. She put our secrets at risk for her convenience. She put national security at risk for her convenience. She put the lives of intelligence officers and law enforcement at risk for her convenience. That's why the stakes are so high, everybody. If she did that when she was Secretary of State, what do you think she'll do when she has no one to answer to as President of the United States? What will she do for her convenience then that will put her interests in front of yours? We need someone to get on that stage in September as the Republican nominee who has fought terrorism and knows how to fight it, who has been in law enforcement and knows how to support our police officers and our intelligence officers, who knows how to support the military in the fight to keep us safe and secure, and someone who recognizes that when you're a governor or the president, your convenience is secondary. What's primary is protecting the safety, security, and well-being of the people who elected you. And if that inconveniences you at times, that's life. It's almost like she was saying that the rules that are placed on her are not fair. I kind of like Donald said, you know, when debate wasn't fair to him, right? So he wasn't going to show up. Hillary Clinton's not going to follow the law because it's not fair. I don't know about how you were raised, but I'll tell you how I was raised. When I used to tell my mother something wasn't fair about a rule, she'd say, "Christopher, get used to it. Life isn't fair, buddy. Life isn't fair. Get used to it. You follow the rules, whether you like them or not. And if you don't like them, go try to change them. But don't not follow them." So we need a president who's going to enforce the law. We need a president who's going to support those who protect our country. And we need a president who's going to wake up every morning knowing that his first and most important job is to protect you and let you do what you need to do with your lives, your families, your careers, your futures. And that's the kind of president I'll be. So no big other speeches for me this morning. I'd rather get to your questions, especially now that I figured out what day it is and what state I'm in. So now I'm completely oriented. It's great. So there's only one rule for this. Raise your hand and I call on you. For the rest of it, you just ask me whatever it is you want. I see one of my staff guys back there holding the microphone. You don't need a microphone for this. Folks are going to stand up and speak boldly to me, and we don't need to run around and put microphones in their faces. So raise them up, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Let's start with this guy right here.
Hi. Welcome back to Iowa, Governor. My name is E.J. Wallace. I'm a father of a three-year-old. I'm an Iowan, and every day it's about my son's future. One of the things that we're going to do to try to ensure that he has a good future is we're going to place him in a quality early learning program. But it really bothers me that, you know, over half of Iowa's 3 and 4 year olds are not enrolled in a quality pre-K program. And we see very similar kind of statistics around the country, and it ends up being a very negative social determinant for our kids later on. And since it's one of the best investments that we can make as a country, I'm kind of curious as to what you plan to do, if elected as president, to ensure that every young child has an equal opportunity to succeed through an equality early learning program, and maybe what have you done as governor in New Jersey as well?
Well, we have, thank you for the question, we have very aggressive early learning programs in New Jersey for 3 and 4 year olds, especially for those children that we deem at risk. In our urban areas, where the statistics for achievement academically are pretty dire. And so what we found is, especially in those instances, often you have children who are in either broken families or families where they're cohesive, but the parents are working 3 or 4 jobs to keep a roof over their heads. And so they're not home to help teach the child to learn, not home to encourage them to be doing things that are productive, starting at 3 and 4 and then all the way through the school time. So in New Jersey, we've spent a lot of time and energy and money on those at-risk children to try to take them from at-risk to reaching their full potential. And that's all any parent wants. What I would do as president is to continue to encourage each state to pursue that kind of goal. The fact is that I think that the top-down approach from Washington doesn't work. So for instance, you know, when we look at Head Start, Head Start has done a lot of good things over the course of time. But also, maybe that money could be utilized better in a state like Iowa if I gave the money to Governor Branstad and said to him, "Here, what do you want to do in Iowa for early childhood education? What do you think makes the most sense?" Instead of all the strings I'm attaching to it with Head Start, maybe if I gave it to you and Iowans could help you develop what's best for them, which will be different than New Jersey. I mean, New Jersey is the most ethnically diverse state in the nation, a very urbanized state, and the most densely populated state in the nation. 8.9 million people in that little thing right there. And we're like, it's stuffed like a sausage in there, everybody. There's a lot of folks there, right? And so, you know, I would like to give flexibility to the governors to be able to make this determination and help give them the funding to do it. Because we're doing it in a bunch of different ways now. Let's let them decide. I think if Governor Branstad, Speaker Paulson, others were able to sit down and say, "Okay, we have this pot of money from the federal government that can help with early childhood education. We're going to put some state money into it too. And we're going to design a program that fits Iowans, that deals with the homeschool folks here, gives them an opportunity to be doing things differently, deals with folks who are living in more rural areas, and then deals with the more suburban and urbanized areas of Iowa. Each one of those places needs a different kind of program. Let an Iowan design that program, not some bureaucrat at the Department of Education in Washington, D.C., or the Department of Health and Human Services. So that's the way I would approach it. And I think doing that, we can help with the resources, but let you make the decisions. Because you know what? Education, to me, the single most important element in the decision-making process are parents. Parents have to be empowered, because when you're empowered as a parent, you own it. You own it, and then not only do you love your child more than anything you think you could ever love in the world, but then when you know you're empowered to help make those decisions, you're invested in making those decisions work. And that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to empower you even more than you're empowered now. You're passionate about this issue. And you know what? If we empower you and you're passionate, success is going to come. Not only for your family, but for other families that are affected by your passion on this issue. That's the way I'd approach it as governor, as president of the United States. All right. Yes, ma'am.
Hey. So I've always been taught that competition is the cornerstone of capitalism. It drives innovation, leads to better customer service experiences. And I've also noticed that the internet seems to be sort of the cornerstone of the 21st century economy. So I'm wondering what you might do as president to increase competition in internet, particularly broadband providers, and you know, open up the world of broadband to more Americans, particularly in low-income and rural areas.
Well, listen, I think that that's something that needs to be dealt with as part of an infrastructure plan. You know, our infrastructure needs to be dealt with in a number of different ways, and that's why I put forward a corporate tax plan that would lower the corporate tax rate from 35% to 25%, would wipe away most of the special kind of loopholes and deals that they have down in Washington, and also would do one other thing. There's about $2 trillion offshore right now that is not being brought back because we tax it at the highest rate in the world, and we double tax it. They pay tax overseas, and they got to pay tax again. I'd say repatriate that money one time. We'll charge you 8.75% tax if you bring the money home. Take that 8.75% of $2 trillion and invest in infrastructure. And what do we mean by infrastructure? Roads and bridges, yes, but also the internet and protecting the electric grid. Those four things are really important for America's future. We need to have good roads and good bridges for us to travel around this country on, and we need to make sure we invest in that. We need to have a protected electric grid. Everything we do depends upon the ability to turn these lights on, for you to charge that phone, for us to use this microphone. Everything that we do depends upon us having reliable power, and we know that there are people, not only by mistake, but people intentionally, who are going to try to take that grid down, and we need to make sure that we do the best we can to protect it. And then lastly, the internet, as you said, for us even folks, Mary Pat, my age, folks your age, the internet is something that's become new in our lives during our lifetime. For our children, this is their way of life. I remember our now 15-year-old son, when he first started taking computers in grade school, he said to me, "So, Dad, who is your computer teacher in grade school?" There were no computers when Dad was in grade school. You know, so it's, we need to upgrade that. And by making it more available to folks, what we're really doing is increasing what this gentleman was pointing out, too. These are educational opportunities. And you look at the way our children deal with finding out information, so much different than what we did. My children don't have the first idea what the World Book Encyclopedia is, right? They know Wikipedia, you know? I keep telling them, not the most reliable thing in the world, go to some other sources as well. But the fact is that that's what we need to do, and that's how I would do it. Take that 8.75% of $2 trillion, that's a lot of money. And we could use it to invest in partner with the states on roads and bridges, and then have the federal government take a larger role in helping to expand internet access and protect our electric grid. We do those four things, we're really helping to secure a better future for all of our families, and that's what I would do. Thanks. Thanks for the question. Yes, ma'am.
I want to thank you for helping the woman who found herself in your little state of New Jersey with guns in her car.
Very welcome.
And you really did help. Why does the NRA only give you a C? And what do you need to change to raise that rating for those of us who are strong supporters of the right to bear arms?
I think the NRA gives me a C because I'm from New Jersey. All right, and so here's the thing. all these gun laws that they object to were all passed before I became governor. And I have a Democratic legislature. So what I've been doing is holding them off from making it worse. So they tried to ban the 50 caliber rifle, we vetoed it. They tried to reduce magazine capacity from 15 to 10, I vetoed it. They tried to make a, require a statewide ID system for all gun owners, I vetoed it. And as you mentioned, there's now been six people that were in the same position as Shanine Allen, who was the young woman who was driving from Pennsylvania to Atlantic City and was pulled over on a traffic infraction, legally owned a gun in Pennsylvania, and was faced with criminal charges in New Jersey for carrying that gun in New Jersey, and faced jail time. Well, we pardoned her, and we pardoned five other people in the exact same circumstances, starting all the way back in 2010. So this wasn't something that started in the last year or two. In the Christmas of 2010 was the first time I pardoned someone who was traveling through our state. They legally owned a handgun in their state, but got caught up in a traffic violation in our state and wound up facing time for that. I'm trying to change that law. The legislature won't change it. So what I told them is, you won't change it, then I will pardon every person who gets charged.
And so that's why.
And so, I've had lots of discussions with the NRA. They've spoken to me and said, we really need to relook at your grade and change it and all the rest. Now they're involved in politics and the politics of, do they really want to change a grade in the middle of a presidential race? Guess what? At the end of it, I haven't gotten many C's in my life, so I'm not happy about it. But for this one, it's a C for my state. I don't think a C for me. And I think the things that I've done regarding the Second Amendment over my course of time in New Jersey, you should go and look at the website of the New Jersey Pistol Club. Scott Bach, who's an NRA board member, he has said that the Second Amendment would not exist in New Jersey if it wasn't for Governor Christie. And so there are some states where you can play offense. Yeah. There are some states where it's good to have someone who can play defense. And I've been playing defense to protect the Second Amendment. As president, I'd be able to play offense. Well, thanks for your question. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Governor. I'm Joanna Cabalfort. I'm the Deputy Ambassador of the Netherlands Embassy in Washington, D.C., and visiting Pella as being a Dutch heritage.
Yes.
So I'm very feeling welcome up here. And that's why I would like to ask you a bit about our longstanding relationship between my country and your country. And we have been working together and facing challenges together, and we're still thankful for the U.S. to come to our rescue after during the Second World War, and we've been celebrating that with a visit of our king and queen last year. But we're facing huge challenges now. As the Netherlands is holding the EU presidency the coming 6 months, we're faced with a huge migration crisis. We're working together in a coalition with the US on fighting ISIS. But there's been a constant strain also on the transatlantic relation. So I want to know your view on the transatlantic relation and how you're looking at Europe and how we can keep on working together to face those tensions.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. And welcome to Pella. Welcome to a town hall meeting. And so I'm glad you raised the issue. First, let me tell you that New Jersey and the Netherlands have some great connections, too, as you know. And in fact, President George W. Bush's ambassador to the Netherlands, his first ambassador to the Netherlands, was a man from New Jersey. Ambassador Cliff Sobel was the first ambassador to the Netherlands. And really, I know Cliff and Barbara so enjoyed their 4 years of their posting in the Netherlands and got to know the people of your country and felt really, really privileged to have the opportunity to interact with you. On the transatlantic relationship, listen, the American people need to understand that there's nothing more important for us than to reestablish the strong bonds that exist between ourselves and our European friends. This president has put a lot of strain on that. You're a diplomat, I'm not asking you to comment on that, but I believe that this president has put great strain on those relationships. And the fact is that we need to sit down, and one of the things I said was that I would convene in my first 100 days individual meetings with the leaders of our major European allies and ask them to come to Camp David individually and sit and listen to them about what their vision is for their nation's future and how that interacts with their vision for the world's future and how the American country can be helped, how we can work together. We have not done enough listening, I don't think, in the United States, and we need to do more listening. Doesn't mean we're always going to agree. We'll have our disagreements, but we have many more things in common than we have differences. And with the EU right now in the migration crisis, this is a failure of the President of the United States in part. You know, fact is, he should have set up a no-fly zone in Syria and a safe zone in Syria so that Syrians who were threatened by their own civil war and by their own government could stay in their own country and be kept safe. I don't mind people running away when they think they're going to be killed. That's a natural human instinct. But they don't want to leave their own country, and they don't want to, you know, come into Europe. And listen, right now, as you probably know, the fourth largest city in Jordan is a refugee camp. And the inundation of refugees into Europe is going to affect the character of the continent. And it's going to affect, I believe, its safety and security. So the United States should work with the Netherlands and our other European allies to say, okay, we all have skin in this game, so let's work together to set up a no-fly zone and a safe zone in Syria. Let's stop the flow of refugees out of Syria. Let's keep them in their own country as we then work together to resolve what's going on in Syria. When the president said, if Assad uses chemical weapons on his people, we will attack him, and he did not, he set up this crisis in Europe. Because those 250,000 people have been murdered by Assad, the rest of those citizens saw those people die and say, not us, not me, not my husband or wife, not my son or daughter, so we're gonna run. And I think it's caused an enormous crisis in the EU, and one that I don't think we even still know the full depths of, and we need to stop the bleeding. And that's only going to happen if America works with our European allies and, quite frankly, our Sunni Arab allies to make sure that we do this together. And then we fight ISIS together, because that is also a threat to all of us. So those are the ways I would approach it and how I think about the European relationship. And I'm really glad you came. Thank you very much. Sir, in the back.
Governor, it's my opinion that political correctness is a form of bullying, and that it degrades the quality of public discourse because it subtracts certain opinions from that discourse. My question then is, do you believe it's important as president to establish a climate in this country where everyone feels free to express their opinions so that we can collectively make the best decisions?
You bet, man, I'm from New Jersey. You tell you, you wanna come to a place where everyone freely expresses their opinions? Come to my state for about 15 minutes, man. You are going to feel the free expression of ideas. And of course, in New Jersey, we start with criticism and then we work from there. So I absolutely believe that. And I don't think anybody in my political career has called me politically correct. Definitely not the poster boy for political correctness. As late as last week, you know, I was being called politically incorrect on a number of things that I've said. The fact is, I'm gonna say what I believe. And I think that a president does set a tone in that way. That I think every American under the First Amendment has the freedom of speech. And they have the freedom to say what it is they believe in their hearts and in their minds. And a president needs to be encouraging that at all times, whether he agrees with their opinions or not. And so in my state, there are more opinions at times against me than there are for me. And certainly the opinions against me at times are louder and more vehement than the ones for you. That's kind of typical. And you have to know, learn that that's the way it works in public life, and not attempt to be shutting down those voices, but just attempt to either try to convince them otherwise or to convince more people onto your side of the ledger. I've been pretty good at that over the years, having won twice as a Republican in a blue state, and we can do it again as a country. But the idea that, you know, opinions are things that should be restricted in this country is dangerous. It's dangerous.
May I follow up then?
Sure you can.
Because
if I told you no, that would be right? No, shut up, you know?
But we do find, for instance, on many college campuses, and I'm not saying that's true here, but many places where they have these free speech zones or whatever, where they are trying to restrict the expression of opinions. Again, what do you do about that kind of what looks to me like an obvious violation of the First Amendment?
Well, first of all, all those people who feel as if their rights are being restricted have access to the courts. And they should take advantage of that in this country. We have access to independent third-party arbiters. They're called federal judges to enforce your ability to be able to express your constitutional rights. The problem that's going on a lot of college campuses is that the political philosophy of the leadership of the college tends to demean folks who have a different opinion and to restrict their ability to express themselves because they don't agree with their position. And that's done both directly and through peer pressure. And so, you know, these colleges and universities are our colleges and universities in the main, right? There's public ones and private ones, but we're the ones funding them. And so we need to demand certain things from these folks as we go forward. And part of the fight against political correctness is to demand that voices are allowed to be heard. And so on the individual basis, folks have access to the courts. They should make absolute use of that. And on a more global basis, we should be continuing to encourage people to express the views that they feel, even if we disagree with them. And you know, that's what a race for president should be all about too. Sometimes it isn't, but it should be. And that's what I'm certainly gonna be. I'm gonna say what I think. People can agree with it or disagree with it. You can vote for me or vote for somebody else, but I'm not gonna keep quiet just because you don't agree with everything I say, or maybe decide you wanna vote for somebody else. I, of course, don't want you to vote for anyone else, but we'll do our best to do our job to make sure that you don't. And thank you for raising it. Appreciate it. Yes, ma'am.
When I kind of look around this room, different people are here for different reasons. I come from a farming family, so renewable fuels, trade issues are really important to us. And earlier when you talked about being in New Jersey, being a Republican governor, working with a Democrat, and getting things how are you to do that in Washington, D.C.? It has been a very frustrating 8 to 12 years.
Yeah.
And I just share with us how you're going to work with this.
Sure. Well, I'll do it in the same way that I've done it in New Jersey. There's no easy way to do this, first off. So anybody who comes in and says, oh, no, I've got this figured out. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine. Leave it to me. It'll be great. Yeah. It won't be. It will be backbreaking for the president. But it's up to the president. See, this president doesn't even have good relationships with Democrats on Capitol Hill, right? We've all read that. Here's why. The only way you're gonna have good relationships when you're the president or the governor with members of the legislature or Congress is to spend an inordinate amount of time with them. Every member of Congress wants to feel special. They want to believe that they're important, and they are. But the way that you make them feel important as the executive is to spend your time with them. There's no other way to do it. You know, it's not like I can give them an extra little bonus at Christmas time, right? I mean, how do you make somebody feel special? It's the expenditure of time. How did Ronald Reagan work with Tip O'Neill? Well, the way he did it was not because all of a sudden Ronald Reagan became Tip O'Neill or vice versa. They did not. But Ronald Reagan used to have Tip O'Neill to Camp David. He used to have him on Air Force One. He used to have him to the White House on the Truman balcony for drinks at night when no one knew what was going on. But they sat there and talked to each other and got to know each other. Here's why that's so important. It's so important because when you get to know each other, when you develop a personal bond, when you keep your word to each other, it's a lot harder to not get things done. And those personal relationships are all we have in governing. We don't create anything. You're from a farming family. You create something, something tangible. What you produce on your farm is the tangible product of your hard work, and you can offer it to people for sale. What do we offer as government? All we offer is governing. And if you don't do that well, then you're really out of business. And that's what you're feeling the frustration of. I got great advice from the guy who's currently the FBI director, Jim Comey. He was the U.S. attorney in Manhattan when I was the U.S. attorney in New Jersey in the Bush years. And he was then my boss for a period of time as the deputy attorney general. He came to visit me one time, and he met with all my met with all my lawyers. And then he and I met privately. And I asked him what he was doing after he left my meeting. And he said to me, oh, I'm going to the New York Times editorial board. I said, Jim, you work for George W. Bush and John Ashcroft. You're a Republican and you're going to the New York Times editorial board? Do you have a death wish? And he gave me the best political advice I've ever been given in my life. And he didn't mean it in a political context. He said, no, Chris, you misunderstand. I'm going to the New York Times editorial board because it's harder to hate up close. That's the way you're going to get Washington to stop being dysfunctional. You stand up for your principles. You make sure that people know who you are because it is harder to hate up close. And in Washington right now, nobody talks to each other anymore. You know what place I'd like to ban? That place on Capitol Hill where with all the microphones, where they all stand behind each other and they say awful things about each other, then the Republicans leave, then the Democrats come in, they say awful things about the Republicans, and then they leave again. If they wanted to do that, I'd make them do it at the same time. Stand there at the same time, two banks of microphones, say it to each other's face. They won't. Make them talk to each other. Make them understand that, you know what? I was shocked to hear that 4 months ago, John Boehner was on Air Force One for the first time. He's been the Republican leader of the House for 6 years under Barack Obama. He's never been on Air Force One. So I want to warn you, when I'm elected president, if Nancy Pelosi is still the Democratic leader of the House, she's coming on Air Force One whenever she wants. I mean, she can even steal the M&Ms if she wants. I don't care. Whatever she wants to do. Because every time she gets on there and I spend 10 or 15 or 20 minutes with her, she's going to realize that I'm a good person, even if she disagrees with me on some things. And I hope that what I would realize is she's a good person, and that we would learn we have to keep our word to each other. And that's the way we're going to break this up in Washington. We're not going to break it up by sending somebody who's already in the middle of that fight down there to you know, referee the fight. I say all the time, I've got a Democratic legislature, Democratic Senate president, Democratic head of the lower house. I'm like a marriage counselor. Those two guys fight with each other all the time, and they complain to me about each other. Like, oh, he was unfair, Governor, you can't believe what he did to me. And the other guy comes and says, oh, you think that's bad? You see what he did to me. The president has to be the conduit through which frustrations are expressed, aspirations are expressed, and results are delivered. And if you're unwilling to spend that time, don't ask for the job. You know, Mary Pat reminds me all the time that I volunteered for this, right? And when I complain to her about the people I have to spend time with, like I said, you know, in New Jersey, I spend more time with people I don't like than I can even count. But that's part of the job. I don't have to love them. I have to respect them. I have to treat them with respect because people have elected them. I'm not the only one who was elected. They were elected too. I'm not the only one with principles. They have principles too. And that's the way we're going to fix it. But not by sending, you know, Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or one of these other Washington, D.C. guys down there. They've been the ones who have been in the middle of creating this problem. So why are you going to send somebody who's been in the part of creating the problem down to fix the problem? It doesn't make any sense to me. So that's the way I would deal with it. Really good question. I appreciate it. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Lopez. I'm from Philadelphia. And I was wondering if
first, on the first part of your question, this is the first time I've heard of TRIO. Thank you for what you're doing. I don't know whether I'd support it as president because it's the first time I heard about it. So you're going to help. You're going to give me your contact information before I go, and you're going to help educate me on TRIO. This is the greatest thing about running for president, by the way. You pick up people all over the country who become your unpaid advisors. They raise a question you know anything about. You say, okay, you're smart about this. I'm not. You teach me about it. It's great. It's like going back to school, and I enjoy it. So I would love to learn more about TRIO, and then I'll be able to answer you about whether I would support it as president. On the debt issue, I'd say four things. First, we need to allow students who take on this debt to refinance their debt. Right now, the law prohibits people from refinancing their debt. They can refinance it at lower rates. They're not allowed by law. We're making money off our kids. It's obscene. If they can refinance it commercially at a lower rate, they should be able to. That'll help to bring down some of their carrying costs. Second, I want to provide a national service option for every one of these kids who has student debt. So that after you leave school and you have this debt, if you want to dedicate 2 or 3 or 4 years of your life to national service, it doesn't have to be military service, it can be non-military service. There's so many things in this country that need to be done. And if we had good, enthusiastic, hardworking young people who were incentivized by the fact that we could wipe away their student debt, depending upon the number of years they were willing to work, that'll do three things. The first thing is it makes our country a better place because they realize there's something bigger than their own self-interest. And they work on it and they improve things in our country. Second, it's going to absolutely help them to to take away the stress and the anxiety that goes along with carrying that level of debt. Third, when they're done with their national service, it's going to allow them to follow their hearts and what they want to do with their career and not worry about, I have to make a certain amount of money because I have to pay this debt off. Now, we've all done jobs at times, I'm sure in this room, for a paycheck that we didn't love. I've done them, I'm sure you've done them. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, there's great value in just going to work every day to get paid and to help support your family. But I find that we always are doing better when we follow something that our heart leads us to. We're better at it. We're enthusiastic. We jump out of bed in the morning to go to work, right? And we're reluctant to leave at night. I want kids to have that sensation. I think providing them the national service option does. Two things on the cost side. Colleges and universities, present company excluded, I'm sure. They're taking us to the cleaners. Yes. They're taking us to the cleaners. And you want to know why? Because there's no market forces on these prices. And you know why there's no market forces on these prices? Because we don't make decisions in spending money on college and university the way we make decisions on everything else. So for instance, if you know you went to a car dealer and you walked in to buy a new truck and the truck was $80,000. And you went to them, okay, well, what's the real price? They said, no, it's $80,000. You go, well, you know what? I'm looking at that truck. It doesn't have a value of $80,000 to me, so I'm not going to buy it. And you'd get up and walk out. Here's the problem with colleges and universities. Our oldest daughter goes to the University of Notre Dame. Wonderful place. We walk on that campus. We love it, too. You can't help but love it, right? It's just a warm, welcoming, fabulous place. It also gives her a great education. We got a letter from them this summer telling us that, and the first paragraph was something like this. It said that it's for Father John Jenkins, the president of the university. He said, dear parents, we want to thank you for the blessing that you bestowed upon us by entrusting the souls of your children to our care and education for the next number of years. Right, from a Catholic priest, right? I mean, you close your eyes, you can hear the theme from Rudy playing in the background, right? You can close your eyes, you see touchdown Jesus, you see the golden dome, the heart is pounding. Now, for any of you, are there any Catholics in the room? Raise your hand. Okay, so for the Catholics in the room, here's what you know what the next paragraph is, right? It's the money paragraph, man. It's a priest. They work the heart, then they go for the wallet. The next paragraph was telling us that tuition was only going up 3.9% this year in a 1% inflation world, and worse yet, that it was the lowest increase in annual tuition at Notre Dame in 40 years. 3.9% was the lowest annual increase in 40 years. Now, if I were making that decision like I was making the truck decision, right? And it's now $62,500 for 1 year at Notre Dame. Mary Pat and I might sit there and say, you know, we love the place and everything, but for $62,500, maybe we can send her someplace else for less where she'd get just as good an education and experience. Now, for any of you in this room who have had or currently have a 19-year-old daughter, how do you think that conversation would go exactly? Right, we bring Sarah downstairs, we say, Sarah, you know, we don't think this is a value anymore, we've made analysis, and so you're gonna be going to fill in the blank school, whatever it is, because it's less expensive and we think a better value. I think the way we go in my house would be after the crying, the stamping of the feet, running out of the room, slamming the door and yelling, you're ruining my life and I hate you both. After that, you know what would happen. We would sit at the kitchen table and figure out how to send her back. Here's the problem, they know that too. It is an emotional decision, right? So I look around this room, and I do this at every town hall meeting, right? We got somebody there with a Central College track and field sweatshirt on. Let's see how we're doing. What other colleges? Another Central one. Central back there. You're wearing these things, right? There is an emotional connection. You didn't just pick that up this morning, I suspect, because it was on top of the pile. You picked it. You picked it. We feel an emotional connection to where we went to school and to where our children go to school, and they exploit us. So here's what we need to do to bring market forces on it. Two things. First, we need to make them detail what they're spending our money on. Wouldn't that be interesting? Because our oldest son, by the way, is also in college. He's at Princeton. Now, I just paid that bill about 3 weeks ago. It's three lines. Tuition, room and board, other fees. $29,000-something, right, for the semester. Now, if you went to a local restaurant here and you sat down at the table and they put the check down and you turned it over and it said food, $30, you'd call the waiter over and say, excuse me, could you detail out here exactly what I ordered and how much each one of those things cost? But for the college thing, 29 to 5, okay, where do I send the check? They should have to give us all the detail, because if they did, we'd be outraged and they'd be embarrassed. Because they spend like no one's watching. And you know why? Because no one is. Secondly, you should be able, and any student should be able, to unbundle their bill. Buy the things you're going to use in your college education. Not everything. Like, you know, I don't know, here at Central, do you have a rock climbing wall at Central? Thank God. Thank God for the wisdom of the people at Central. You are the first college I visited that did not have a rock climbing wall. There's an epidemic in America on college campuses of rock climbing walls. Thank God. I'm going to hold Central up now as an example of wisdom in America and frugality. But, you know, pick the things you're willing to pay for. That puts a market price on it. If 98% of the people won't pay for the rock climbing wall, it's not getting built. Right. And so, then how am I going to do this? Your next question should logically be, okay, how? If you're not willing to do those two things, you don't get to participate in this federal student loan program or grant program. You're going to take our taxpayer money, you're going to answer our questions and be held accountable, because those kids are accountable when they have to pay that debt. Those parents are accountable when they have to write those checks. And the people who get that money should be accountable too. That's the way I would deal with it. Thanks. Happy to be back.
Appreciate you taking just time out of your career to try to become president. My question, what would President Christie do with Supreme Court nominees and federal judges?
Sure. Well, I'll say two things. I'll give you both the characteristics and I'll give you an example. The characteristics are that I would want someone who understands that the role of a federal judge is to interpret the law, not to make it. They're not elected by anybody. And the people elected make the laws, the judges interpret those laws and interpret the Constitution. Don't create new rights, don't create new things in the law that the people who are elected don't, because if the people who are elected create those things and we don't like them, we can kick them out. When the judges do it, we can't. And it's incredibly frustrating. It's anti-small d democratic. Now, if you're looking for a kind of person that I would put on the United States Supreme Court, you need to go no further than the guy who used to have a job that I had. I used to be the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey. One of my predecessors is a guy named Sam Alito. He is now Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito. And I got to meet him and know him when I was U.S. Attorney in New Jersey. He's a wonderful guy, but here's why I love him as a judge. He's quiet, he's smart, he's conservative, and he's consistent. You know every day when you read a case, if you follow this stuff, which I do, you'll be able to predict how Sam Alito is going to come out. And that's the kind of Supreme Court justices we want, who are conservative and consistent and know their role. So what I would do as president, if I had an opening on the Supreme Court, the very first thing I would do, because I think we made a mistake in the past, Republicans don't pick people with paper trails. They say, oh, we don't want someone with a paper trail, right? Because that'll be harder to get them confirmed. So we pick people with no paper trail, and then when they get in the Supreme Court, they drink the water in the building, and all of a sudden they become a liberal. And we say, what the heck happened, right? We saw that with David Souter, right? I mean, you know, here's this like supposedly conservative guy from New Hampshire that Bush 41 puts on the court. Before you know it, he's voting with the liberal side every time. I want someone with a paper trail. So I would go to Sam Alito, and I'd ask him to come to the White House. And Mary Pat and I know Sam and his wife, Martha, really well. We'd invite him for dinner. And I'd say, Sam, I want a list of the best federal circuit court judges that you've seen opinions come up from to the Supreme Court who are like you. Who are the five people that you agree with most of the time? And then I'd take those names, and those are the men and women I'd interview. I would want it from someone who is actually living this thing every day. I'm in and out of it as a president. Sam Alito is seeing those opinions come up every day to the Supreme Court. He knows who are the reliable, smart, quiet, consistent conservatives and who aren't. And that's who I'd ask. I'd ask Sam to give me the names. And then those are the people I'd interview, and that's how I decided to put on the Supreme Court. Last thing I'd say about Sam is that I went to see him when I first became U.S. Attorney. He was a Third Circuit Court of Appeals judge. This will tell you how humble he is. Now, this is a guy who ran the U.S. Attorney's Office, worked at a high level in the Solicitor General's office at the Justice Department, then became a Third Circuit Court of Appeals judge. And I went to see him and I said, listen, I'm just starting the job as U.S. Attorney. You had it. Can you give me some advice on how to run the office? And he looked at me and said, oh, Chris, I ran it many years ago. It was much smaller than it is now. You're a smart man. He said, you'll figure it out. I'll be here to help wherever you can. But he said, it's not my right to give you advice. That's restraint. That's lack of ego. That's the kind of person I want on the Supreme Court. That's the kind of people I'll appoint. All right, to tell me I can take one more question, which means I will take two. And here's why. Because I want to prove to my staff that I'm the boss. You laugh about that, but you know what it's like to run for president? Here's what it's like to run for president. You're surrounded every day by people who are younger than you. And they tell you where to go and what to do every minute of every day. This is the only place right here in this circle, right here, where I am free from the tyranny of the young. And so when they say one, I say two. So we're going to take two more questions. We'll start with this young lady right here.
Hello, Governor, of course. My question's on military. What is your stance on foreign policy in the Middle East, and how would you fight terrorism? And the same thing goes for North Korea.
Wow. That's like 17 questions. That's deep. All right. We'll do a few things. First off, I want to tell you that for anything I don't cover now, go to my website before you decide to make your decision on who to vote for or what to do, because I list out all the stuff that you're talking about in detail with speeches that I've given on my website. It's great if you want to find out detail about what I stand for, or if perhaps tonight you're having trouble sleeping, then maybe you can go right in there. This will put you right out. Don't you worry about it. Start reading that stuff. If you're a little bit tired, right under. On North Korea, let's start there. China has to be engaged in controlling its neighbor and friend. China cannot pretend as if they don't have the biggest influence on North Korea, because they do. And China is going to have to control North Korea, or when North Korea acts badly, China's going to have to pay the price. It's kind of like North Korea is spending with China's credit card. China's going to have to pay for the credit card. So if North Korea is going to start testing nuclear bombs again, like they did just a few weeks ago, if North Korea is going to be belligerent, China is going to have to pay the price. And that's exactly the way I would deal with China on this. North Koreans are crazy. Kim Jong-un is crazy. You can't negotiate with someone who's crazy. But the Chinese are not. And they control what goes on in that country. And they can assert themselves if they want to, and they need to. And that would be one of the early conversations I would have with the president of China. On the Middle East and dealing with terrorism, listen, I'm the only person in this race who's dealt with it. No one else that you saw on that stage last night has had any direct responsibility, decision-making authority, planning, execution on fighting the war on terror. I did it for 7 years. I was appointed U.S. Attorney by President George W. Bush on September 10th, 2001. The job I accepted on September 10th became significantly different the next day. And so I spent 7 years of my life fighting terrorism. Here's the way you have to do it. First, protect the homeland. Use every intelligence and law enforcement capability you have to keep you safe. We can do it within the Constitution. We're going to do it within the Constitution. But we cannot do what we did this summer, which was give away authority from the NSA that Senator Paul and Senator Cruz and President Obama did, which gives them less tools and makes us less safe. I'd restore those tools. Overseas, we have to put together an alliance, like I was talking about with the woman from the Netherlands. Our European allies and our Sunni Arab allies have to understand that ISIS is a threat to them as well as us. And if we're going to fight ISIS, it's not going to be America by itself. It's got to be everybody together. That's the best way to defeat them, and it's the best way to not encourage greater membership in their organization by saying it's just the great Satan, the United States, who's fighting you. It's everybody who's fighting you. Last thing is, if we're going to do this, the military has to be rebuilt. We have the smallest active duty army we've had since 1940, the smallest navy we've had since World War I, and a much, much smaller Air Force than we've had before, and smaller Marine Corps. So what we need to do is to invest in rebuilding our military. I've said in speeches and on my website, no less than 500,000 active duty soldiers in the Army, no less than 185,000 active duty Marines in the Marine Corps. Go from 260 ships to 350 ships in the Navy, and no less than 2,600 coded aircraft ready to go in the Air Force. That will send a deterrent message to the rest of the world, and it will lessen the number of deployments our fighting men and women have to have and the length of those deployments, which is affecting both their physical well-being and their mental well-being. We can't do that. That's the way I would approach those things.
Thank you.
Now I can take a breath.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, sir. Last question.
When you were answering this young gentleman who was left about the early childhood education, something you mentioned was a pot of money for the government. You just mentioned that we're going to increase our military. It's all cost money. Our country's faced with a $19 trillion debt. We're constantly running that debt up. Where does all this money come from? How are we going to serve it?
Sure. Listen, it is now why I'm the only person in this race who has put forward a plan to reform entitlements. Why is that important? 71% of our federal budget today is spent on entitlements and debt service. 71%. Back when Jack Kennedy was elected president, it was 26%. 26. So we have to reform entitlements. They're going broke and they're breaking our back. So I put forward on my website, you'll see it, I'm the only person in this race who's put forward a detailed 12-point entitlement reform plan that has been scored by the Congressional Budget Office as saving over $1 trillion. Now we're talking real money. That's money that you can use to help invest back in building the military. That's money that you can help. And by the way, with his question, we don't need to spend more money on that education. We just need to reconfigure it. What I was saying was we're spending this money on Head Start now, take the strings off it, give it to the governors, let the governors decide how to spend it the right way, rather than have the federal government tell them each way they have to buy every pencil and every notebook and the way they have to teach every word of the curriculum. I'm not for that. I'm for letting local people decide that. So on the education, we would need to spend more money. But on military, we would. Where I get it from is savings in entitlements over time, and $1 trillion in it. And let me tell you quickly, I'm not gonna give you the 12-point plan because we'll both fall over. But here's the thing, I'll give you the four points on the two programs that people care about the most, which are Social Security and Medicare. On Social Security, we need to raise the retirement age. Here's why, everybody's living longer. It's a blessing. The average life expectancy of a woman in this country is now 83 years old. The average life expectancy of a man is 79. These programs were designed for when people died in the mid-60s. So we're taking money out of the system 15 to 20 years longer. Can't sustain itself. The checkbook doesn't balance. So I'd raise the retirement age 2 years and I'd phase it in over 25 years. Because what it really needs to do is to lengthen how much of this money we're gonna be paying over the long haul. So for someone who's on Social Security now, it wouldn't affect them at all. For someone who's close, it would affect them for a few months because it's only 1 month a year would go up. So it's 67 now, a year from now it'll be 67 in 1 month, etc. Every year going forward for 25 years. It would not affect me or you all that much, but it would affect my children. And it should, and that's the way you actuarially make it much more sound. Second, we need to means test Social Security. Fact is, if someone's making $200,000 a year or more in retirement, that means they got $4 to $5 million saved. God bless them, great job. You raised your family, you get to retirement, $4 or $5 million in the bank, great job. But do you really need a $1,200 a month Social Security check on top of that? I mean, seriously, I know you put the money in, I know. But here's the problem. The government lied to you and they stole from you. Okay, I hate to be the guy to tell you, but I am the guy who's gonna tell you. They stole from you. It was supposed to be in a trust fund. It was supposed to stay there in the trust fund. Remember Al Gore talked about it, the lockbox, right? Right now you're thinking to yourself, am I remembering Al Gore? Or am I remembering the guy on Saturday Night Live who played Al Gore? Today? For purposes of this conversation, it doesn't matter, okay? Just remember the lockbox, all right? Guess what's in the lockbox? IOUs. IOUs to the federal government. So we have a problem. We have a checkbook imbalance. When you have a checkbook imbalance, you got two choices. The federal government's no different. You got two choices if you really want to sustain it. More money in or less money out. I'm a less money out guy. And the reason I'm a less money out guy is because they already stole the money. Now, Hillary Clinton will say, take the cap off the Social Security tax and charge Social Security tax on every nickel you make because that'll get the rich people. True point. Because when you lift the cap and you do it on everything, wealthier people will pay more. But under my plan, the wealthier people get less. So why is my plan better than hers? Here's why. Let's say someone opened up a new bank here in Pella. You went and you put your money in the bank. And then a year later, the bank went belly up and you lost some of your money. And then 6 months later, the guy who opened the bank comes to your front door and he says, hey, by the way, I'm opening up a new bank in Pella. And you go, hey, wait a second. Aren't you the guy who opened up the bank that I put my money in and I lost some of my money? why should I give you more of my money? You go, oh, because I learned my lesson. Iowans are really nice. I've gotten to learn that over the last 9 months. You're very nice people, very kind, very warm, very giving. He's not leaving your front porch with money, is he? No chance, okay? So here's the thing. Why would you give it to the government? They already stole from you, man. And now you're going, okay, well, the way to fix the problem is give them more. Give them more? That's what Hillary Clinton wants. No chance. I'm not giving them more. I'm giving out less. It affects the same people, but you don't have to trust me to not write a check. I just won't write the check. But if I'm taking your money, you got to trust the Congress. The Congress. The Congress. So when they have three choices, that they're going to make the right choice. Either they're going to raise taxes because they're spending too much, they're going to cut spending because they're spending too much, or behind door number three is this pile of money that no one's really watching right now that I can heist and no one will know it and the next guy will have to deal with it. Which one do you think they're picking? They're picking door number three, everybody. But if door number three opens and there's no bag of money there, out of luck. Out of luck. So that's what I would do on Social Security. Same thing on Medicare. Raise the eligibility age 2 years, phase it in over 25. And for people who are making over 200 grand a year in retirement, instead of subsidizing your Medicare 75%, only subsidize you 10%. You still get a subsidy, but you know what? You got money. You can pay for your health care. More of it. We'll still subsidize it 10%. The taxpayers will still kick some money in for the money you've put into the Medicare system, but you don't need a 75% subsidy. And you know who needs it? The people who that's going to make the difference between rent and heat and food. The people who have worked hard and played by the rules but didn't get as lucky as you did. Didn't work as hard as successfully, but worked hard. And they're counting on that Social Security check to keep them afloat. We have to have Social Security there for those people. And that means we got to make hard choices. And the reason we got to make hard choices now is because we didn't make them before. You know, my mother used to say to me all the time, Christopher, you cannot rob Peter to pay Paul. Because eventually, Peter comes back looking for his money too. And so that's what's happening now. So that's where I would get the money to pay for the, some of that military buildup I talked about. But it's also where I would solidify the Social Security and Medicare programs to make them sustainable for the next 25 years. So that people could understand and count on the fact that when they need that, it's going to be there for them, both on Medicare, so they don't have to just go to the emergency room and be treated, and on Social Security, so if they need that to keep the roof over their heads and buy food and keep themselves warm and have a reasonable lifestyle in retirement, then it's there for them. And that's the way I would deal with it. So, I have to go now. I'm doing three more town hall meetings today all across Iowa. I'm really happy that you came this morning. I hope that what you learned from the debate last night is this. This election isn't over because of any particular poll. Iowans have proved over and over again that you're going to wind up voting for who the heck you want to vote for. And regardless of what the polling says, regardless of what the pundits on TV say, regardless of any of that, you're going to have the chance, like this, to meet the candidates face-to-face, eye-to-eye, judge their character, judge their intellect, judge their ability, and then go vote for someone. I had a guy the other night here in Iowa on Wednesday night say to me, well, if you don't win the Iowa caucuses, wouldn't I be wasting my vote voting for you? And I said to him, I got to tell you the truth. If you're voting for me because you believe in me, you're never wasting your vote. And your vote could make the difference between me being in one place or another, which affects the next election in New Hampshire and the next one in South Carolina. You will launch people out of Iowa, and you will send people home after Iowa. Who do you want to send forward, and who do you want to send home? And that's the way you should be making these decisions. In your heart, who do you believe is ready to be president of the United States? Who's tested? Who's mature? Who's going to get the job done? Listen, everybody, it's been an entertaining campaign. I've been happy to be a part of it. It's very entertaining. Right? You think you've been entertained watching on TV at home? Try getting on that stage. You can't imagine how entertaining it is, right? We've had senators and former senators, governors and former governors, business people, and a character. Right? But I want to remind you all of something that you know in your heart already. It's fine to be entertained. But showtime is over. It's game time. It's game time for this country. Showtime is fun. We all like to go to the movies. We all like to go to a show. We all like to laugh. We all like to have a good time. Who do you want representing this country to the rest of the world? Who do you believe can really get in there and fix these problems? That's what you're doing. That's game time. We are not electing the entertainer in chief. We're electing the commander in chief. And the other night, in the debate, when Mr. Trump was asked about the nuclear triad, go back on the internet and watch his answer. Watch it. The single most solemn obligation you have as president is that you command the largest nuclear arsenal the world has ever known. Go back and watch his answer. And if you do, I am confident the decision you'll make. We need someone who is going to keep us safe and secure, someone who will fight for us, but we also need someone who knows what they're doing and what they're talking about. And Iowa starts that parade. And so I'm really thrilled to be back in Pella. I've been here before. I'm glad to be back. This time I brought my wife. I don't know if I'm going to be leaving with windows or not, but I'm hoping to get out of town relatively quickly without any new windows. There's a guy back here with Capella,
yep.
That guy right there. No offense, buddy, but you know, money's tight right now. You know what I'm saying? We're on a campaign trail. It's very tight. I appreciate your willingness to participate in this process. It's extraordinary what Iowans do, how much time you spend, how much care you put into these decisions. And so when you go to caucus on Monday night, I want your vote. I hope I have your trust and your confidence and that I get your vote on Monday night. If I do, we're going to change the course of history and we're going to do it together. So thanks, everybody, for coming up.